It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson joins us to wrap up a week-long look at transportation issues here in Wisconsin. First, Vice President Mike Pence was in Wisconsin today, along with House Speaker Paul Ryan. Pence attended a private event in Janesville, where he spoke about President Trump's economic agenda, health care, and other topics. The visit took place at the same time as some new reporting about the vice president was making headlines. Yesterday evening, the Indianapolis Star reported that Pence used a private email account to conduct official business in his former position as the governor of Indiana, an account that was later compromised by hackers. It didn't take long for critics of Pence to point out his vocal opposition to Hillary Clinton's use of a private email account during her tenure as Secretary of State. But what do we know about this story so far, and is it fair to compare these two cases? Abby Phillip joins us now to talk more about this story. She's a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Abby, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
In the words of the Indianapolis Star, Vice President Mike Pence routinely used a private email account to conduct public business as governor of Indiana, at times discussing sensitive matters and homeland security issues. So, first off, how did this story come to light?
Well, Mike Pence's emails have been the subject of a lot of scrutiny for quite some time now, including that he had sent some emails related to his opposition to Syrian refugees being resettled in Indiana. But beyond that, Pence has also been a sharp critic of the former Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server when she was Secretary of State. And the Indianapolis Star has been doing a lot of work on this and had put in a public records request for Pence's emails from a private email account that was pretty widely known that he had been using throughout his time as governor. And what they found was that the account had essentially been compromised at least once, and that he was conducting a wide range of business on that account, personal, government-related, and so on and so forth, raising some questions about his own criticism of Clinton during the campaign.
Do we have any idea how extensively he used that private email account?
We have a little bit of an idea. Sources in Pence's office have told me that he has had that particular account since the 90s. So it's a personal account that he has used for quite some time, and he used it throughout his time as governor. And part of the reason that he did that was because Indiana does have a law that requires that political communications are not handled on government email accounts. So Pence would have used that account to deal with issues that might have been in a gray area between the political and the official. It appears that he used that it for other government work as well, but that might have encompassed conversations between aides, just as a source of a form of communicating directly with some of his closest aides. So it's a little bit unclear how far his use of this account went, but we do know that he used it throughout his time as governor.
Do we know about the content of some of these messages?
Well, some of them were definitely private in nature, but others would have been communications with his staff about strategy. There were a couple of emails that had to do with some FBI arrests in the state of Indiana. Now, the complication here is that those arrests were being discussed publicly in news reports around that same time. So it's not clear that that information would have been considered private or even confidential. At the same time, there are a lot of emails that were not released to the Indy Star, partly because the state of Indiana had deemed them to be sensitive or confidential and that they should not be released as part of a public information request. So that suggests that there was some information being transmitted on this account that was private in nature and so private such that they could not be eventually released.
So based on what we know so far about the actions taken by the vice president with his email and Indiana law, I mean, was anything that occurred so far, as we know, against the law?
As far as we know, it doesn't look like there was anything against the law, and I think this is the big contention of Vice President Pence's office, is that there is no prohibition against Pence using a private email account as governor. There is also no classified information that he would have been dealing with because he doesn't have a security clearance and wasn't an official working at the federal level. So there wasn't anything illegal. There were some questions raised about whether all of those messages would be archived in accordance to Indiana's public records laws. And it looks like it's very likely that they will be, at least Pence's office has said that all of those emails will be in compliance with public records laws. So there isn't anything much illegal about it, but critics are definitely raising comparisons between Trump's use of multiple email accounts while serving as governor and Hillary Clinton's, although the situations are not, they're not exactly parallel for a lot of different reasons.
We're talking with Abby Phillip right now, White House reporter for The Washington Post, talking about Vice President Mike Pence's use of a private email account to conduct some official business in his former position as the governor of Indiana. And Abby, you said that these two cases, Hillary Clinton and Mike Pence, in terms of using, in her case, a private email server, in his case, a private email account, that they're not quite parallel. What do you see there?
Well, the biggest differences are that Hillary Clinton was a federal official. She was the nation's top diplomat and would have routinely dealt with classified information as a routine part of her job. So there was a possibility that in communicating about her work that she would be communicating about a classified or sensitive information. Beyond that, her private email account was being managed on a private server in her home. And that's a little bit different from what Mike Pence was doing. He was using a private email account that was being managed by a corporate entity, in this case, AOL. So the accounts may have been at similar levels of vulnerability. There's no evidence that Hillary Clinton's account was actually compromised. There is, however, evidence that Mike Pence's account was. But Hillary Clinton's account was, as being a private server managed by only her and without the sort of knowledge of people in the federal government, raised a lot more questions about whether it was prudent to be doing any business that would relate to national security from an account that could be susceptible to hacking.
And what has Pence's team had to say about this story?
Well, they are trying to dismiss it and basically suggesting that he did nothing wrong and that what he did was actually in keeping with what previous governors of Indiana have done. That being said, it's been very difficult to explain away the fact that the account was compromised. I think that's probably the most damaging element of the story, that there is some evidence that someone was able to access the account and that there was perhaps not enough care taken to make sure that that information was secure as governor. They have said, though, that once he became the vice presidential nominee during the summer of 2016, that he stopped using all his private accounts and that additional security measures were added so that information would be secure. As vice president, of course, he does not use, at least according to what his office told me, he does not use a private account in that position.
And in general, it's a rule of thumb that there is a little bit more when it comes to cybersecurity when there are official government accounts to use. Is that right?
Right. Well, they're supposed to be at the very least. And there are a lot of more information security controls that are placed on government accounts. There are a lot of things that you can't do from a government account in an attempt to sort of keep that information as secure as possible. And beyond that, one of the most important reasons they officials are encouraged to use or expected to use government accounts is because those documents need to be kept and archived both for security purposes but also for historical purposes. So there are several reasons why there's a shorter leash on government accounts, although nothing is really fail-safe, and I think that it would be a mistake to suggest that that simply by using a government account, everything is automatically going to be as secure as it could possibly be.
And we talked about Vice President Pence's criticism during the election of Hillary Clinton when it came to her private email account and private email server. What specifically did Pence have to say about that in the past that could maybe sound a little different in lieu of the news today?
Well, one of the strongest terms that he's used is that he suggested that his son, who served in the U.S. military, would have been jailed for doing what Hillary Clinton did with her email server. And remember, a common refrain for the Trump campaign and for his supporters was lock her up. That was about Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server. So the suggestion that using a private email account and a private email server was a criminal offense that ought to have landed Secretary Clinton in jail was something that that I think Mike Pence generally signed onto, and I'm not sure that he would really change his view of that now. I mean, perhaps he would be less eager to make this argument, but he has insisted as late as today that he doesn't believe that there's any real commonality between his situation and Secretary Clinton's, and the reason for that is because of the nature of the information, the possibility that Clinton could have been distributing or dealing in classified information through her private account.
Abby, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
That was Abby Philip, White House reporter for The Washington Post. We were talking there about Vice President Mike Pence's use of a private email account to conduct official business in his former position as the governor of Indiana. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we find out why a cast iron skillet might be your new favorite tool in the kitchen. Right now, Wisconsin's transportation fund has reached a point where there are more road projects than there is road funding, and this day of reckoning has been a long time in the works. Lawmakers and governors have ignored warning signs and repeatedly put off the toughest decisions. In our final installment in our week-long series on transportation, Sean Johnson reports.
When events repeat themselves, people will sometimes say, it's like Groundhog Day. They're talking about the movie starring Bill Murray. His character famously wakes up to Sonny and Cher on his clock radio.
Then put your little hand in mine.
And he gets anxious when he wakes up the next morning to the same song.
Then put your little hand in mine.
Didn't we do this yesterday?
I don't know what you mean.
Don't mess with me, pork chop.
Murray relives the same events over and over again. Every day is Groundhog Day. It's an apt metaphor for Wisconsin's transportation debate. Back in 2006, for example, Republican Assemblyman Mark Gottlieb chaired a special committee on transportation. It produced a report that explored new ways to fund roads.
Revenues was obviously always going to be the most challenging thing here.
Flash forward to 2013 when Gottlieb was Wisconsin's transportation secretary. He chaired another special committee that produced another report that explored new ways to fund roads.
Transportation fund revenues available over the next decade will be inadequate to preserve the current condition of our network.
2 years later, the legislature's budget committee ordered Gottlieb's DOT to produce yet another report on road funding. Lawmakers also ordered an audit of the DOT. Republican Senator Robert Coles, the audit committee's co-chair, was among those bothered when the audit found major cost overruns for highway projects.
This is a very, I would call, consequential audit that points out a number of problems.
The audit felt new. But in 2003, a similar audit also found cost overruns for highway projects. Coles was frustrated after that audit, too.
Is the agency ever going to get real about what dollars they have and what dollars they can spend if we don't deny them a few dollars? I don't think so.
But the state didn't cut DOT spending. And even when Democratic Governor Jim Doyle used the transportation fund for other bills, he borrowed money to partially repay it. After Republicans took complete control of state government in 2011, Governor Scott Walker attacked the state's reliance on borrowing.
These are no longer options, and their use has only delayed and worsened the difficult decisions we must now make.
But with Walker opposed to tax or fee increases, he borrowed too. And by 2015, debt had gotten high enough that Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss was pushing back.
I mean, if we're not going to create any new revenues, maybe we don't have any new bonding. So there's a lot of options in the middle.
The state ended up borrowing $850 million for roads in the last budget. This budget cycle, Walker and Voss are at it again. It all feels familiar, like events are repeating themselves. But in budget debates, as in Groundhog Day, eventually things change.
Do you know what today is?
No, what?
Today is tomorrow. It happened.
When Bill Murray's Groundhog Day finally ends, everything works out for the best. But depending on your perspective, Wisconsin's transportation debate may not have a happy ending. Walker's budget would delay and cancel road projects. Some Republicans are calling for tax increases, and debt has hit an all-time high. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Sean Johnson joins us now to wrap up this week-long series titled Wisconsin Roads, A Turning Point. Sean is WPR State Capitol reporter here at WPR. Sean, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you call the place Wisconsin is in now when it comes to transportation funding a day of reckoning. Why is this the crucial moment?
It just feels like we've hit this point where this problem we've seen coming for a long time has arrived. And, you know, we want to do more than we can afford. And that's been the case for a while. We've gotten around it. The legislatures and governors have gotten around it for a while through borrowing. But that borrowing has built up over time. And so we're at this point now where it's kind of put up or shut up time. Is the legislature and the governor going to increase taxes or fees to pay for roads? Or are they going to start cutting road projects? And at least so far, it looks like they're choosing the latter. Governor Walker is starting to delay or cut road projects.
What projects are looking to be cut right now?
You look at one that he, in his budget, decided to cut, and that is an expansion of I-94 west of Milwaukee. It was a contentious project in that neighborhood. I mean, it's not like it was universally beloved, but it is something that the business community in Milwaukee definitely wanted. And traditionally, they've gotten what they want. I mean, a road project like that, when the business community was on board, was a pretty easy sell for Wisconsin governor, especially a governor like Scott Walker with ties to the Milwaukee Metropolitan Association of Commerce. That's not the case this time. He's decided not to move ahead with that project. We found out this week that they're scrapping plans for an expansion from four lanes to six lanes of I-39, 90-94. From Madison north up to the Dells. That's something that Walker talked about wanting to do when he was running for governor. He's not going to do it. And, you know, those may be the tip of the iceberg here.
And those are some bigger roads. What about, you know, small roads in towns, municipal roads? What are we seeing there?
Yeah, and for part of the series, I looked specifically at some town roads and specifically towns that have had to turn paved roads back into gravel because they can't afford the upfront cost of repaving them.
And before you go on, Sean, have you ever seen that before? A town that turns its paved roads into gravel roads?
I hadn't seen it in Wisconsin before. And I mean, the town that I can tell you, the town that I kind of highlighted in that piece, I visited a couple times because the first time I went up there was covered in ice and snow and I wanted to go back and see it myself. And they turned 12 of their 48 miles of roads from paved roads back to gravel. And it's just a matter of they can't afford to pay for asphalt up front. So if you just look kind of at a micro level at the governor's budget, you'd say, well, towns do well in this budget. He's proposing an 8.5% increase in the amount that the state sends to local governments for transportation aid. So by that measure, they've done okay in this budget. But if you look at the long-term trend for towns, they basically get their money from three sources. You know, this funding from the state that's called shared revenue, that's gone down. Funding from the state for transportation, that has been flat. And then property taxes, which have been frozen under Governor Scott Walker. So they don't have the money. And so, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if other towns start following that trend, too.
We're talking with Sean Johnson right now, WPR State Capitol reporter, talking about his week-long series, which we just wrapped up today, called Wisconsin Roads, A Turning Point. And, Sean, let's talk for a moment about the Tommy Thompson years. When Tommy Thompson was governor, by many, this was reckoned to be the golden age of roads in Wisconsin, apparently also by Thompson's reckoning. What did he have to say? You talked to him.
Yeah, he spoke really fondly of his days of building roads. I mean, he talked about Highway 29 specifically as he had kind of a love affair, was his quote, with that road. And you look at Thompson, he's somebody who came from a small town, Elroy, and the roads that the road projects he was really proud of were those big road projects that connected more rural parts of Wisconsin with the rest of the state. He was able to do that because back then Wisconsin had a law that was actually signed by the governor prior to Thompson, Tony Earle, a Democrat. It was gas tax indexing. And this was something that was, you know, we also talked about in the series this week. It increased the gas tax automatically to keep up with inflation. You know, Thompson credits that law. When I asked him, how were you able to do all this building? He said right off the bat, we had gas tax indexing, and that let us do it. He knows that some people viewed that as taxation without representation. He understands that, but he said the trade-off is when you don't have that, legislatures don't vote to increase the gas tax, and that's been true, and then you have highway infrastructure that eventually crumbles.
Yeah, those are a couple options on the table. Something like the gas tax index, toll roads have been kicked around a little bit, vehicle registration fees, user fees, all these things. Is any of that likely to come into play now that, as you say, we're at this crunch point when it comes to funding for roads?
You do hear a lot of lawmakers talking about an openness to toll roads in Wisconsin, but it's really out of their hands. I mean, the federal government would have to make changes to allow Wisconsin to add tolls to its roads. So that's sort of a red herring in all this. When it comes to gas taxes and vehicle registration fees, some lawmakers, some Republican lawmakers have said they're open to that this session. But the governor has taken such a hard line stand against it that Republicans would really have to get Democrats on board for that, because they'd almost certainly have to override the governor's veto. And that's something they haven't done in the past and seems unlikely they'd do it. One other option for them is they can take money from the general fund. So that's money that's set aside for schools, for prisons, for health care, for the poor and elderly. That is something they have shown a willingness to do in the past. And it's something that even today, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said he's considering doing in the future.
Well, since we may be at this turning point now, as you say, a day of reckoning, what happens next now that we're at this moment for Wisconsin roads?
I think a lot of people who have been watching this debate unfold over time, you know, over the last 10, 12 years or so, have been thinking there would come a day where you'd have this really dramatic vote and they would finally take some vote to fund roads. That's the way these things unfolded in the past. I'm not so sure anymore. I mean, I think there's a possibility that the drama is actually happening right now, that we don't realize it, but we've already gotten there. You know, these road projects are already being delayed, and that it's just the beginning of a trend.
Sean, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. You can read and hear all five parts of his series, Wisconsin Roads, a Turning Point, at WPR.org/roads. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday, and this week we'll take a look at recipes you can put in your cast iron skillet. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, it's our weekly news roundup with Robert Menser from USA Today Network Wisconsin. We'll look at some of the top stories from the past week, including news that Wisconsin wages are growing. First, throughout the years, cast iron cookware has been eclipsed in many ways by its fancy Teflon cousins. But while some cast iron skillets may have been relegated to the sidelines, in recent years, these hardworking multitaskers have had a renaissance in kitchens across the country. Charlotte Druckman joins us now. She's the author of Stir, Sizzle, Bake, Recipes for Your Cast Iron Skillet. Charlotte, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Charlotte, why did you decide you wanted to write about what could be a blast from the past in some ways, cast iron?
Well, it was sort of unexpected. I had done a story. I write about food for the Wall Street Journal, and I had done a story on baking bread on your stovetop, so that you wouldn't even have to use your oven, because I sort of am of the belief that bread is one of those hurdles for a lot of home cooks, and I personally was really taken by this idea that you could bake bread on a stove without having to deal with the oven. And it turned out that all of those recipes involved cast iron skillet, and I was approached after doing that story by someone at Clarkson Potter who said, you know, what would you think about doing a book on baking in a cast iron skillet? And I'd never thought about writing a cookbook before. I honestly had no idea what I was doing, but I really loved the challenge of it. I really loved those pans, and I also liked the idea that you could focus on baking and you could maybe do it in a way that hadn't been done, which is to say to make it a little bit more sophisticated and get more adventurous with flavors and think beyond, you know, the sort of typical things that we associate with cast iron.
What are some other surprises about things you can do with cast iron that maybe you wouldn't think of right off the bat?
I started started realizing that it was better. It was almost easier to look at what you can't do on cast iron, because I can't believe, I mean, I had a pastry chef from New York named Pichette Ong. I wanted to do a curry pretzel, and I knew he made really good pretzels, and so I wanted to ask him for his sort of base pretzel recipe that then I could play with. And when I did, he said, "Oh, hey, but I have a souffle." And I was like, "Uh-huh, that's nice. You know, like, what does that have to do with anything?" And he said, "No, it's a souffle that you make in a cast iron skillet." And I just thought, "Is that doable?" It is completely doable. So it's actually a pancake flavored souffle, and it's wonderful. And it rises. And I mean, I don't know about you, but that's definitely not something that I ever would have thought that you would make in a cast iron skillet. So that may have been the most surprising.
What's special about cast iron skillets that you can do some of this stuff that you wouldn't think of, say, with, you know, a Teflon, a nonstick pan, or aluminum? What makes it unique?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the ability to get that sort of incredible crust. I always say, you know, you can look at it in terms of savory, or you can look at it in terms of pastry or baking, but the equivalent of searing a piece of meat, if you kind of think of applying that to the idea of baking, and you get these just really, like, incredibly golden crusts, right, and then this tender crumb. And I think that that's something that you really can't do in a lot of other pans. You can't. I also think, you know, nonstick is controversial. The one thing that I don't recommend doing on cast iron, if you have a choice, because it can be done, it's not optimal, egg cooking. Hmm. I think cooking eggs, I did a lot of research on it, and then just for having done it myself, the cast iron is pretty hard on the eggs. The eggs are also not so kind to your skillet. And that's maybe the one thing where I would say having a nonstick, like a Teflon pan, if you're someone who makes eggs a lot, I would actually say, okay, go and get that. But otherwise, I am hard-pressed at this point to recommend a nonstick pan in most situations. If you take care of your skillet and you season it well, it will begin to behave in a nonstick manner, but then just the ability to get that crust and that heat is something that isn't really matched by another pan.
Well, let's talk about the seasoning aspect before we get to the recipes, because that can be a hurdle for some people. I think it took my husband and I quite a while to figure out what was going on with it and how you were supposed to clean it. So there's that aspect. And then there's also, you can get cast iron with enamel on it these days.
Yeah.
And you can get it with just, you know, the cast iron as the surface. What do you recommend there?
I think there are two different things in a way. The thing about the enamel, I love, you know, like I love a beautiful Dutch oven and that surface. But if you're talking about doing that thing where you're cooking something on really, really high heat and getting that sizzle, whether it is, again, a piece of meat or you're putting a cornbread batter in there or something, the thing about the enamel is if you heat it too high before you put anything in it, it can crack. And for most of the kind of technical stuff you're doing with cast iron, you actually do want to heat your pan in advance. You want to preheat it and get it nice and hot before you add anything to it. And so if you think that that's what you're going to be doing, if you want to do any baking, I would say don't go for the enamel. Go for just the straight up cast iron. I think in the end it's more versatile anyway. Although the enamel stuff is beautiful, and you can do a lot on it. But the enamel makes it a little bit closer to a traditional sauté pan that happens to be oven-friendly, whereas the cast iron allows you to crank the heat really high.
Okay, so that gets us to the seasoning of the pan itself. So let's say you've taken your advice, you've gotten the regular cast iron pan, not the enamel. What do you do to season it?
Okay, if you're buying a new pan, most of the new ones now, at any price point, come pre-seasoned. And that means that you're going to have to do the minimal work to maintain it. And, you know, maybe before the first time you use it, you'll rinse it out. People are surprised to learn that you can use any kind of dish soap. You know, you're not going to use a bleach. You would never, ever put your pan in the dishwasher. But any sort of mild, generic even dish soap, you would rinse it out. you dry it. Every single time you dry your cast iron skillet, it really needs to be thoroughly dried, because the one thing you're trying to avoid is rust. So dry it really carefully. My trick is to put it on the stove over very low heat for anywhere between 5 to 10 minutes after I've dried it with like a towel. It means that any water that may have been trapped in there gets out, but it also opens the pores, if we can say that a pan has pores. It opens the pores of the pan to receive the oil, which is when you first buy a pre-seasoned pan, you will do this, and you will do the same thing when you're done using it and cleaning it. You'll just add about a teaspoon, no more than that, certainly, to the pan, and you will coat, you know, use a paper towel or some kind of cloth to rub that oil all into the entire surface of the pan. And if you get it warm first, in addition to making sure that, you know, the pan's completely dry, it just allows the pan to take in that oil. So that's sort of like your regular maintenance. But let's say you went and bought a vintage pan that, you know, needed to be seasoned, officially seasoned. It's really, really easy. It's a thing that you do 3 times, and I think that's sometimes maybe what throws people off. But the same way that you rinse it and then you dry it, this time when you oil it, you're then going to put it in the oven, and you're going to set the oven to 450 degrees with the pan in it. And then once your oven reaches that temperature, you're going to leave the pan in the oven with the oil on it for an hour. Then you're going to turn the oven off, let the pan cool down, take it out, and do that again 2 more times. And that's how you season an unseasoned pan. That's it. I mean, it could not be easier.
Well, let's get to one of your recipes. And there's a huge array of different things. As you said, I can tell that you had fun with this, because
yes,
there are things you'd never expect. And one of the recipes that you gave us is called Extra Coconutty Eggs in a Hole. Tell us about that one.
Yes. Well, so that started with a breakfast roti that you would find in Sri Lanka. And I had seen...
And roti is a bread, a type of bread.
Yes, but I think most of us, when we think of roti, we think of this sort of Indian roti that tends to be thinner, and this is actually a bit thicker. The batter is more almost like a cross between like a real thick pancake batter and a dough. So it's like a little bit in between. And I tweaked that a little bit to make it super coconutty. Like I used more coconut. I like to cook it in coconut oil. I just really wanted to push the coconut of that. And I also add a little cardamom to it, because I think the combination of coconut and cardamom, so beautiful. One of the things that I wanted to do with this book was to also look at the way that we use leftovers, especially with baking. I think baking can be a labor of love, and it was sort of this idea of, you know, you made this whole loaf of bread. Maybe you don't eat the whole loaf of bread. What are you going to do with it? Or you made sticky buns, and you spent, you know, a long time making the dough and proofing the dough, and you don't want to waste the sticky buns. So in that spirit, I sort of started to play with some of the things that had already been made in the cast iron skillet and thought about what else I could do with them. And with this, I don't really know why my brain went here so much, except that when I was a little girl, my dad used to make egg in a hole for me and my brother. You know, traditional egg in a hole. He would put cheese on it. And I just had this thought of actually, the Singapore dish kaya toast, which has that sort of salty sweet thing happening, where it's that like coconut jam on toast, and the jam sort of seeps into the toast, and it gets dunked into an egg, and then you serve it with some dark soy sauce. So it's really, I love this dish, and something about that roti with its coconut in it, and then that idea of the egg made me think of my dad, and I thought, well, what if you could turn that roti into an egg in a hole? And so you use the same batter, and you just cut out a hole in it as it's setting, and you put an egg in there. And that's a situation where I don't mind cooking an egg in the cast iron skillet, because it's sort of buffered by the batter.
And that recipe, by the way, for the extra coconutty eggs in a hole is up with a couple of others on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking to Charlotte Druckman right now for this week's Food Friday. She's the author of the book Stir, Sizzle, Bake, Recipes for Your Cast Iron Skillet. And we want to hear from you. Do you have any questions about cast iron cooking or maybe a favorite recipe you like to share that you love to cook in your cast iron skillet? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can leave a comment over on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. It's Food Friday, and we're continuing our conversation about cast iron cooking with Charlotte Druckman. She's got a new cookbook out. It's called Stir, Sizzle, Bake, Recipes for Your Cast Iron Skillet. And we want to hear from you. Are you curious about cooking or baking more with cast iron? Maybe you've got some questions about how to do it. Maybe a favorite recipe that you love to make in a cast iron skillet. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we've got our first caller now. We've got Becky on the line in Verona. Becky, hi.
Hi. I was introduced to cast iron skillets when I lived in Kentucky because every single night we made cornbread in them. But right now my favorite thing to make in it are hash brown potatoes because they come out so crispy, and I finish baking them in the oven after I start them on the stove, and that way they stay real fluffy inside. And my second favorite thing are steaks. I'll heat the cast iron skillet up really hot on top of the stove, throw the steaks in there for maybe 30 seconds on each side, and then they put them in a 500-degree oven for 2 minutes, and The steaks are absolutely perfect that way.
I bet they're so good.
Yeah, Becky, thanks for that. Interesting. So first of all, let's start with cornbread, because that seems like the quintessential thing that you make in your cast iron skillet. Do you have a favorite cornbread recipe for the cast iron skillet, Charlotte?
Yeah, well, it's funny. Someone asked me recently what I thought the best thing to sort of start with in your cast iron if you're trying to season your kind of, you know, like break your pan in. And I think cornbread is actually that thing. If you want to break your pan in, like you've just opened it, you're ready to use it, go for cornbread because it uses a substantial amount of usually a fat in it, and it really helps you get that kind of like coating on your skillet. I don't know, it's hard for me to say that I have a favorite. I put three in the book, and I did one that was a little bit more traditional, except that it includes caramelized onions and some a bay leaf and just a teeny bit of lemon, which just kind of wakes up that corn, that sort of that flavor in the corn that makes it a little bit more kind of almost green tasting. And I love that one because I think it's very sort of straightforward. But that said, the other two, one of them, again, this is just you get weird ideas in your head and then you think, I should just go see what happens if I make this. I was thinking it would be kind of cool if you could turn Frito corn chips into part of the flour by grinding them up really fine in the food processor.
Wow.
And then I was thinking that I really like pimento cheese, and I love this idea of kind of dunking the Frito chips into the pimento cheese. So that cornbread has the Frito crumbs in it as almost as part of the flour. But then it also has got some really sharp cheddar and some pimentos and a little bit of Tabasco sauce. So, I love that because it's a bit playful, but it's also, I mean, it's delicious. And then the other one was, you know, there's a lot of discussion about whether or not there should be sugar in cornbread. And it's a regional thing. People have different feelings about that. It also turns out I read an amazing article about how a lot of that's actually based in race and the way that the black population in the American South cooked versus how white people were making their cornbread. So there's a lot there, and I just, on the ignorant level of how I like things to taste, I found consistently I liked my savory cornbread not to have any sugar in it. But then I thought, wouldn't it be fun then to do one that was sweet? You know, not like overly sweet, but to go there and just deliberately do a sweet cornbread. So there is that also in the book, and that uses sesame seeds and some coconut, and then I used, it's going to sound weird, but it's actually a great trick, some melted vanilla ice cream in the batter, which is how you get the sweetness in without adding just like straight up sugar. But it also gets you a really lovely crumb, a sort of a moist, dense crumb. So
those all sound terrific. I'm still stuck on the Frito pimento cheese one. That's what I want to make.
Thing to make. It's so fun, really. It's delicious, but it's just it's like a fun thing to make.
Let's take another caller. We've got Robin with us in Delafield. Robin, hi.
Hi there. You asked for favorites, and I actually own an organic gluten-free food company, so I love this conversation with the experimentation. I developed a gluten-free pizza crust that I adore in cast iron.
Ooh.
And it's made with sprouted sorghum flour and sprouted brown rice and arrowroot, and you add and it's a yeasted crust, and you add olive oil and apple cider vinegar and warm water, and and what's interesting about the cast iron is it's a par baked crust because gluten free crusts, well, typically they tend to be flavorless and more like cardboard.
Yeah,
in a cast iron. It ends up being where it's like it's a dough that you use wet fingertips to spread in the oil pan, and it's par baked, and then it's topped and baked again, and it's awesome. Like you said, it creates a wonderful crust, but then a tenderness to the dough that is beautiful. I also love again the cornbread. I did a coconut flour.
Yep,
the coconut. Sprouted cornbread. Yeah.
Try doing it. I mean, not to be pimping my own, you know, my book, but if you try it, the combination of coconut with sesame is really, it's unexpected. And I also sneak some brown butter in there, which obviously doesn't hurt. But try doing it, the coconut and sesame, and see if you like it.
And the pizza crust in the pan, that sounds like a great one. Get a crispy take on the bottom, maybe almost like a pan pizza. Well, Robin, thank you so much for calling and telling us about that. And let's take another call here from Cindy in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
When the first information about nonstick pans came out, I went exclusively with cast iron. And I have... It used my cast iron pans for making eggs every single day. What I have found works well for me is I do put a little bit of oil in the bottom of the pan.
Yeah.
Not a lot, but then clean up, I just run it under hot water. And you know the plastic cards that you get when you check into a hotel?
Yes.
I use that as a scraper.
Oh, that is genius. That's great.
Great, Cindy. Well, so she's a believer in making eggs in the pan. So, Cindy, thanks a lot for that.
If you've had your pan for a long time and it's really, like, well-seasoned, you will find it's easier and easier to make eggs. But I just still think that the proteins in the eggs, they do nicely on a gentler surface.
All right.
Just me. Definitely scrambled eggs. I think fried eggs, probably on the cast iron skillet, you're not going to see too much of a difference. But like that scrambled where you kind of want that tenderness.
And Charlotte, we have to get you to talk about one more recipe before we let you go. The halva fudge bars. If you could just describe that one kind of briefly.
That was that I had had. There's a place in New York that was making these blondies that had halva sort of like on the top, and they were really dry. And I was very sad about this because I really liked them conceptually. So I thought I would try and build a better halva blondie. And I did mine with teff flour. I played around a lot with flours in that book just because when you're doing any project where you're sort of constrained by a control, in which case it was like every single thing was going to be in a cast iron skillet, so it makes you want to sort of experiment in other places. So I played around a lot with flour, and teff flour for this kind of thing just gives you something really, really moist. You don't necessarily like to use it when you're doing things that are leavened. But for something dense like a blondie, it's just beautiful. And I also use date syrup because that combination, I think, of halva and dates, they just go so well together. And I think one of the tricks of that recipe too is that I put the halva in the middle. So I put half of the batter down in the hot pan, and then I sprinkle the halva on it, and then I put the rest of the batter on top.
And we leave it there. Charlotte, sounds delicious. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Charlotte Druckman is the author of Sir Stizzle Bake, recipes for your cast iron skillet, and you can find three of those recipes up right now on the Central Time Facebook page. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
Does she handle analytic geometry?
Absolutely. And she speaks.
Yes, sir, I do.
Which one?
Both. Geometry and speaking.
You think you can find me the Frenet frame for this data? Using the Gram-Schmidt
orthogonalization algorithm? Yes, sir. I prefer it over Euclidean coordinates.
That's Taraji P. Henson, who played the role of Katherine Johnson in the critically acclaimed movie Hidden Figures. Katherine Johnson is now famous for her pioneering work in mathematics at NASA, including her work with the Apollo 11 space mission. And coming soon, Lego is planning the ultimate tribute to Katherine Johnson with its new Women of NASA set, which will include Johnson and other women who made important contributions to the U.S. space program. Other women on the list for consideration are Nancy Grace Roman, also known as the Mother of Hubble, a nickname she got for her role in the Hubble Space Telescope, also Mae Jameson, the first African-American woman in space, and Margaret Hamilton, pioneering computer scientist. As Lego puts it, ladies rock outer space. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.